All right, the time is now 11:34. We can begin the meeting. Good morning. My name is Tamika Collier. I am the chair of the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. This is the monthly meeting of BEGA. The meeting has been properly noticed. We do have a quorum. I am here today with our new senior attorney advisor, Rochelle Ford. Welcome, Ms. Ford, as well as Shamari Wade, Norma Hutchinson, and Darren Sovin. The first matter on the agenda is the adoption of the agenda. I will give the board members a few moments to look it over and see if they have any comments or changes. Hearing none, all in favor of the adoption of the agenda, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, the meeting has been adopted. We will now move to adopting the agenda has been adopted. We'll now move to the October meeting minutes. Give you a moment to look those over. Please identify any changes or concerns. Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the October 4th, 2018 meeting minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, the October 4 meeting minutes have been adopted. We will next turn to Ms. Allen. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairperson Collier and members of the board. I am Nikkel Allen, Director of the Office of Open Government, and I am pleased to present this monthly report on the activities of the OOG. The OOG has continued to fulfill its mission of ensuring that all persons receive full and complete information regarding the affairs of the district government and the actions of those who represent them. The first item is a resolution of FOIA complaints and informal Open Meetings Act and FOIA advice. On October 30th, 2018, the OOG issued an advisory opinion regarding the Freedom of Information Act. The OOG advised that FOIA does not support an identification requirement for FOIA requests. An agency should not require a requester to present valid identification to submit a first-party FOIA request. An agency should also not require a requester to present valid identification to obtain the first-party record. This is not a case of first impression for OOG. The frequency of this issue arising indicates the need for either legislation or regulations to address the matter. The OOG suggested models for such legislation or regulations in the advisory opinion.
I do have a couple of questions about this. So practically speaking, if a FOIA officer came across this situation now, a person is requesting information that would otherwise be protected by the Privacy Act. Based on this advisory opinion, what should they do?
Well, there is no basis in the law currently for them to request identification. I guess the actual advice as to what they would do is to maybe just take notes on what has happened and verify the identification without requiring an actual ID, perhaps have the person submit a writing. That is something that they could do. But something short of requesting a formal identification, but the law needs to change to provide the authority to verify it in that way. The FOIA law is just currently silent on the issue.
Okay. And have you shared the opinion or the recommendation with Councilmember Allen or anyone else on the legislative side of the House?
We will do that. We've spoken to them about the issue because, it came up in two other contexts, so they are aware of the issue, but we will certainly share this advisory opinion this week.
Okay.
Well, today.
I had a couple of observations, questions. First, what was the thinking in issuing the opinion? Because when I read the opinion, it seemed to me that not only was it not a case of first impression, because you opined before that there's no identification requirement. So based on that, what was your thinking in actually doing a separate opinion and issuing it instead of just relying on the earlier precedent?
Well, the person who was the complainant was very adamant about receiving written advice on this issue, so we wanted to make sure that complainant was made whole. And also, there was a slight wrinkle to this case. The complainant said that the OUC actually asked for his ID prior to him making the FOIA request. So we wanted to address that issue specifically, although as it notes in the opinion, the OUC has said that that's not their recollection of the event.
And I saw the footnote about that you weren't aware that it had already, that the appeal had already made its way through the mayor's office.
Right.
Maybe is that something, though, in the future that you guys would check before you actually decide to get elbow deep in the case?
Yes, I think that would be a good practice. We'll take that to implement in the future. And according to Johnny Barton, it was not on the mayor's website at the time of the opinion, but we'll make sure to communicate
Got it.
More further.
Yeah. I'm not trying to criticize. I'm just thinking that it might just make sense to, pick up the phone and say, we got this. We're doing an opinion on this. Any background you can give us or anything going on? And they might say, oh, yeah, it already came through and we resolved it.
Well, we did make them aware of it.
And they didn't let you know that.
that's
fine. It's
not that they didn't let us know. I don't think it was ripe at the moment that we had the discussion. It was probably a timing thing.
And just, I did catch a typo in the last paragraph, so
okay.
Maybe pull it off the website, fix the typo, and
okay. Thank you for that.
Sure. No, I thought it was a good opinion.
Since the October board meeting, the OOG's responses for informal and technical FOIA and OMA responses are as follows. There were 6 FOIA and 4 OMA substantive responses and 5 responses to OMA requests for technical assistance. The next item is OMA and FOIA audits. The OOG plans to complete 2 annual audits of public bodies, DC.gov websites for compliance with the OMA and FOIA. The FOIA audit will consist of a review of the DC.gov FOIA tab for the information that the district government is supposed to proactively release under the FOIA statute, which is DC Code Section 2-536A. The OMA audit will review DC.gov for the same information that is required for under the statute regarding public meetings. This audit will consist of a review for information such as notice, agendas, and meeting minutes. The scope of the audits is to determine whether the information posted to DC.gov is current up to FY 2018. For example, in the case of a board, we will be examining whether the board administrator has posted the meeting minutes and agendas through September 30th, 2018. The OOG plans to provide notice of the audits to the mayor and independent agencies prior to commencing. The letter will provide the scope of the audits and when results will be published.
We have a couple of questions on this. First of all, I think it's a great idea to do the audit. One, have you thought about tapping into the internship program to help complete what I assume will be a time-intensive review of websites? And the second one is, other than the initial boards and commission trainings, how do you reach administrators and people who actually are in charge of these websites to make sure that they are aware of the requirements to post the FOIA and OMA requirements?
I guess the primary contact for that would be the Office of the Chief Technology Officer, who maintains DC.gov, and the FOIA officers, as well as whomever the board administrator is for the agency. Outside of training, it is accurate we don't have much contact with the board administrators, so we will have to work on proactively making those contacts to let them know. I think the letter to the mayor noticing the audit is a good first step. Hopefully I'll be filtered down. I will make sure to talk to the mayor's general counsel and also to the mayor's office of legal counsel to make sure that the general counsels are also aware of the requirements. I think some type of a letter, just thinking it through, could be a good solution for that as well.
And the interns, like, how are you resourcing this project?
Right now, we're doing it internally. Attorney Barton and engineer Wada are going through Wada Kitab are going through the websites. But certainly, using assistance from an intern would be helpful because we do have a workload that we're managing. So. Okay. Next is the fiscal year 2020 budget. The OOG, along with the Office of Government Ethics, is working on the FY 2020 budget. OOG is seeking three budget enhancements. First, the OOG is seeking an FY 20 budget enhancement to add an attorney to the OOG staff. The additional attorney is requested because of the anticipated increase in workload due to compliance audit results, the provision of advice to FOIA appellants, and an increased training load. The law requires FOIA officers to have 8 hours of training upon appointment, so the OOG anticipates demand for training to increase as new FOIA officers are continually appointed. Second, the OOG is seeking a FY20 budget enhancement to update the hearing room AV equipment as well as to wire the hearing room when it is moved in anticipation of our office move and to provide maintenance of the AV equipment. Lastly, OOG is seeking an FY20 budget enhancement to produce a training course that may be accessed online for DC employees to receive training credit. And the next item is...
Excuse me, would that be done by an outside entity?
Yes, or by... it could be done by OCTFME. We want to make sure we provide for either opportunity.
And is there a number that you're thinking that based on what you want to do?
For the training video, we would look at the one that the Office of Government Ethics produced as a guide for the dollar amount. So it would be around $30,000. Thank you. The next is training. On October 4th, 2018, the OOG conducted an OMA and FOIA training during Ethics Day. The OOG has created new slides for the FOIA and OMA training, which are available on open-dc.gov. On October 18th, 2018, the OOG conducted a FOIA training for the Office of Unified Communications. And on October 30th, 2018, the OOG conducted a FOIA training for the District of Columbia Sentencing Commission.
I want to highlight the training that you and Attorney Barton did for Ethics Day. I talked to a couple of people, watched most of it. It was very engaging and very well done.
Thank you very much. Last item on our report is rulemaking. The Office of Open Government is working on new and revised regulations, given the recent changes in the law. As you know, the new law permits the board to review certain advisory opinions issued by the OOG. The OOG will continue the drafting process and update the board as we complete the project. The OOG provided the board with draft revisions to 3 DCMR Section 104.06 titled Advisory Opinions in October. The OOG has provided draft revisions to 3 DCMR Section 104.08 titled Public Body Request for Advisory Opinions this month. This section was revised to clarify the process for submitting a request for an advisory opinion and to set forth the appeals process for these opinions.
I do have a couple of comments on those. I'll talk to you afterwards about some of the language, but you had a couple of blank spaces that dealt with timing for board consideration.
Correct.
My first question regarding the approval of any request the OOG director would make for an additional time in which to submit a response is, I wonder if the chair of the board has the authority to grant such a request, because it would be difficult to schedule a special meeting just to vote on giving the director an additional 5 days. So to the extent that chair has the authority to give you additional time to respond, I would suggest you use that instead of a board vote. Regarding how long the board's response would be, I'm not quite sure how to put a time on that, given the board only meets once a month. So I'm not exactly sure what language OGE uses for their regulations for the appeal, but I would use a general reasonable standard.
Okay.
Does anyone else have any comments about timing?
I think it makes sense that the board chair should be able to grant an extension.
Thank you for those comments. We will make revisions accordingly. And this concludes the OOG Director's Report for November 1st, 2018. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wolfenbarger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the report by the Director of Government Ethics. Update on the status of our operations. The past month, we opened no new investigations. We closed 4 investigations. There are 35 investigations currently open, and there are 10 investigations that are stayed or inactive. That is an increase of 3 over the 7 that were stayed last month. The number of stays cases are broken down as follows. 1 is a Maryland court fugitive case. 1 is stayed pending an appeal from OEA to the D.C. Superior Court. 6 are stayed pursuant to OIG investigations, and 2 are stayed pursuant to Civil False Claims Act cases that are being prosecuted by the OAG. Moving forward next month, I do plan on adding some additional statistics to include in this report related to the regulatory matters that we're handling. FDS penalty appeals, lobbyist activity report appeals, FDS designation appeals, things of that nature, which do impact our workload. And I think that we've not really provided enough transparency and insight into the nature of those operations and the status of those matters. So beginning next month, we will supplement our statistics accordingly. Publication and reporting obligations. We completed our performance report for the fourth quarter of fiscal 18, as well as the quarterly complaint report for the last quarter of fiscal 18. Both reports are in the Dropbox.
I do have one question slash comment on the statistics dealing with how long it takes to conduct investigations beyond the 120 days. We're trending up, which is positive, but we're still only at 80%. So the first question is, are those 7 cases included in those numbers to make it 80%, or because they're still open, they're not included?
I don't think that they're included because if they were in a stayed status, I think probably we would accumulate the days until it was put into stay and then basically stop the clock until it came out of stay. Is that the way we handle it, Brian?
Yeah, we only count the cases that are closed.
That are closed. Okay, that's what I thought. Okay. So we have had a conversation about whether 120 days is for formal investigations or for all investigations. Does that, the cases that are included for that metric, is it only formal cases or is it both formal and informal investigations?
It's all cases.
It's all cases. Okay.
Formal cases certainly help the statistics.
Yes. That is what I was getting at. Okay.
Training and outreach, attended by staff, none other than attendance at Ethics Day presentations, which are conducted by both Vegas staff as well as third parties. Conducted by our staff since the date of the last meeting, we conducted or participated in 6 trainings, not including our Ethics Day event, which was held on October 4th and consisted of virtually all the training programs we offer. The 6 other trainings consisted of 2 new employee orientations, our monthly ethics training, 3 Hatch Act trainings just in time for the general election, and a LEAP presentation. This month, we will also resume the regular trainings held in conjunction with the Mayor's Office of Talent and Appointments for new board and commission appointees.
So I do want to take the time before you go out to commend you and the entire OGE staff on Ethics Day. Once again, I talked to several people. I attended several of the trainings, and I also thought it was really well done. And I greatly appreciate the swag.
Thank you.
And good work, Ashley, getting the DC Bar to come in and do its legal ethics presentation. And the food was great, too.
Newsletter. We relaunched OGE's monthly newsletter, which was prepared by Attorney Sonia King with assistance from Wadik Tatab. You will note that it is in a more user-friendly HTML format, and we are continuing to work on securing permission from EOM to have Octo directly distribute the newsletter to all district government employees via email.
So where is the newsletter published?
It's been posted on the website for now, and I'm very happy with the way it looks and the links, and it's just visually more appealing, and I'm very happy. I think Sonia and Wada did a fantastic job.
Okay. I couldn't find it on the website. I was using the mobile version. It's definitely not under newsletter.
Okay.
The last one that's listed is from August 2017. I believe, Ms. Ford, you also looked for it and couldn't find it. So, after the meeting, let's talk about it, and I'll show you what I pulled up and couldn't find it. I also recommend that you publicize it using Twitter. I went to the Twitter account and also didn't see a reference to it, too.
Okay. Well, I think it's kind of timely because the issue is actually dated November. So today's the first day of November, and I think it will make sense for us to release it publicly today or tomorrow.
Okay.
Advisory opinions, advice, informal advice approximately 72, which is higher than the 60 reported at the last meeting. Formal advice requests. We received one formal advice request since the board's last meeting. That request is for post-employment advice and whether a former employee is permitted to serve as an expert witness if it is determined that the employee participated personally and substantially in a particular matter while they were employed with the district. And we're still working up on that opinion.
And of the 60, can you group them? Like, are you seeing a trend?
I'm not aware of a trend. Brian?
No. I mean, if anything, post-employment, some hatchback. There are several kind of strange hatchback questions where video that has 3 seconds of political content, questions with video, interview with the, plus these are interviews with the Attorney General, and while they're doing it, they flash to his election, re-election. 99% of it's not, but
they hatch
and
okay.
Ethics legislation, comprehensive code of conduct. The Council's Committee on the Judiciary and Public Safety reported out Bill 22-0107, the Campaign Finance Reform Act, Campaign Finance Reform Amendment Act of 2018. Although the bill primarily deals with campaign finance matters as it pertains to BEGA, it clarifies that all members of boards and commissions who are confirmed by the council must undergo ethics training within 90 days of commencing service, and that employees who are designated under the local Hatch Act to engage in partisan political fundraising may do so only while on annual or unpaid leave. Further, the bill clarifies the reporting obligations of those employees and BEGA. First reading on the bill would normally be in November. Legislation that does not have two readings before the end of this council period will lapse and have to be reintroduced. Rulemaking. As we informed the board at our last meeting, we have been contemplating rules to further flesh out the procedures and standards to be applied to both FDS and lobbyist waivers and appeals, and to ensure that our lobbying rules are consistent with the changes the council made in the recent Budget Support Act. We have a draft prepared that addresses waivers, but we have not yet finalized rules that address the lobbyist changes. Budget. Wada and I have spent a good deal of time on the data migration project to ensure that the data stored in ProLaw is successfully uploaded into the new system. Wada is planning to upload the data related to all matters that are currently active or stayed from ProLaw into our CMTS test system later today, and if all goes well, we hope to complete the migration of that data into our CMTS live system shortly thereafter. As part of the data migration project, we have been painstakingly reclassifying some cases that are currently classified as either open or closed in ProLaw into a new status being created in CMTS called Closed Pending Collection. We have completed our investigative work and imposed fines against the respondents in all these matters, but we have not yet successfully collected the full amount of those fines. As a result of this reclassification effort, we have actually identified a handful of individuals who have returned to district employment and still owe us money for previously assessed fines, and we are working with OPRS to collect those outstanding fines via garnishment of their biweekly paychecks. Once we complete that effort for the rest of the cases that are in closed status in ProLaw, WADA will conduct the same two-step data migration process for the closed cases that is currently underway for the open and stayed cases. So try to get it into the test system, make sure that there's no problems, then migrate it into the live system. As Director Allen mentioned during her report, OOG and OGE are working together on the fiscal 20 budget. If the board agrees with our analysis, OGE plans to request 5 budget enhancements, 2 of which are for the benefit of the entire agency. First, OGE plans to request an enhancement to fund the agency's relocation to new office space in accordance with the recommendations made by DGS's consultant this past January. The consultant's assessment of our space needs, as well as its notes regarding its analysis and the likely budgetary impact of such a move, were uploaded to the Dropbox for your review. Second, OGE plans to request an enhancement to cover the moving expenses that would be incurred to physically move Vegas furniture, equipment, supplies, et cetera, to the new space and ensure that our phone lines, data lines, network, et cetera, are operational when we get there from day one. Third, OGE plans to request an enhancement that would fully fund the net impact of the position description changes and staff salary increases we enacted during fiscal 18, as well as up to 2 similar changes I would like to enact in fiscal 19. Unfortunately, I estimate that our baseline personal services budget for fiscal 20 falls about $33,000 short of fully funding those changes. Fourth, OGE plans to request an enhancement to cover the annual maintenance fees for CMTS, which were not known or taken into consideration when the budget office compiled our baseline fiscal 20 budget. That's about $29,000 to $30,000. I don't know if the board is aware of this, but when we received our baseline budgets from the budget office, we had received a relatively modest reduction in our baseline budget from the fiscal 19, which is a little concerning, but we're optimistic that when we package together the rationale for our enhancements, that the net impact on operations should be relatively minimal.
Was that reduction citywide?
It's largely citywide. It's my understanding there were a handful of agencies that did not receive a reduction, but by and large, everybody else did.
I wouldn't read into it too much. That was generally my experience, too.
Okay.
Once you request your enhancements and they're good reasons for them, then they're very usually the mayor's office is cooperative.
Excellent.
What's the balance of the O-type funds right now?
The balance of the O-type funds for this fiscal year or overall? I mean, we should probably not have much, if any, surplus O-type funds this fiscal year because they are all being allocated to fund the existing auditor salary
okay.
and fringe benefits.
Okay.
We were able to draw upon local funds to pay his salary last year due to the salary lapses with vacancies, but we do not anticipate that happening again this year.
Okay. That was going to be the first question that you get with these budget enhancements, but... Okay.
And lastly, OGE plans to request an enhancement to fund a second auditor position beginning in fiscal 20 to provide us with a more robust and effective auditing operation by essentially doubling our auditing bandwidth for both the lobbyist and the FDS programs. From conversations with council, it's apparent that they really want to have more transparency and insight into what the lobbyists are doing. I mean, that's the rationale for increasing the frequency of the reporting requirements. But in order for us to basically confirm that everybody's reporting who should be reporting, we really need to have an enhanced auditing presence. And I think doubling the bandwidth of our auditors is a good move in that direction, especially when you look at the number of auditors that the Office of Campaign Finance has on staff. It dwarfs what we have. I think they may have like 8 or 10 auditors on staff. And I would seek to fill that position at a grade 12 step 1 level, which would cost approximately $90,000, including salary and fringe benefits. And for further justification for this proposed addition is discussed later in my report. Staffing. We have two permanent positions that are currently vacant, the third investigator position and our compliance specialist position. Brian, Sonia, and I are serving as the interview panel, and we have interviewed five of the top seven candidates, and we're interviewing the last two candidates this afternoon with an eye toward making a selection tomorrow or Monday.
For the investigator position.
For the investigator position. The compliance specialist vacancy was posted on September 25th for a period of 10 days, and we received 68 applications for that position, many of whom appeared to be highly qualified. However, for reasons that have not been clearly explained to me, DCHR's, quote, system apparently failed to grade the candidate's qualifications, which required them to repost the position. I asked DCHR if I would be able to consider qualified candidates who applied for the position during the first posting, but who might not reapply for the second posting, and was told that I could not. The last time I checked last Friday, we had only received 28 applications through the second posting, which seems like a dramatic drop-off from the original posting and concerns me. However, I will engage DCHR in further discussions regarding the possibility of considering candidates from that first pool of applicants, and I may reach out to the board for assistance in that effort if my outreach is unsuccessful.
Okay. Are you taking this on yourself with DCHR, or are you having staff help out?
Because it's a combination.
Because I didn't have time to do it. I mean, because you got to literally call them every single day.
And yeah, I'm not doing that.
One should probably do it because it's the only way you get results.
Yep.
I will
engage Sandra in that effort as well.
Okay.
And let us know if you do need help. We discussed it. I have had success in writing a memo and getting a waiver of whatever their requirements are.
And we definitely leveraged that experience with the investigator position, because when they gave us the list of highly qualified applicants, it was very disappointing to me, because it was apparent that they had really not done much objective analysis of the candidates' qualifications. They were basically accepting at face value whatever self-assessment the candidates gave on the ranking factors questions, resulting in a situation where folks who had absolutely no investigative experience at all were given highly qualified rankings, where we had three or four folks who had 20, 30 years of investigative experience as criminal investigators for federal agencies that were deemed not qualified. It was just mind-boggling to me. So we did leverage that experience that you guys had, prepared a memo asking for permission to consider other candidates who were well-qualified or qualified, and after some back and forth, DCHR did agree to allow us to do that.
Good.
Litigation. First matter is Garen Price. This case was submitted on October 24, 2018, and we are now awaiting the court's decision. Larry Hicks, this is an enforcement collection action filed to reduce the board's $20,000 fine imposed on Mr. Hicks to judgment. The board imposed the fine in February 2014 after a contested hearing. OAG recently filed a precipice with the court informing it of Mr. Hicks' failure to file an opposition to the OAG's summary judgment motion. Rashawn French versus Bega, employees appealing the imposition of a $600 ministerial fine. Pro se case was filed on April 6th. There actually has been a new development in that case. OAG filed a precipice following Mr. French's failure to file his opening brief. And the next status hearing is set for at the end of this month, November 30th at 2 p.m. Lobbyist financial disclosure matters. There are currently 195 FDS non-filers remaining, 57 of which are ANCs. We sent the first round of PFDS fine letters on September 21st, 2018, and we're continuing to receive and process fine waiver requests. Which brings us to the next item, FDS waiver requests. First one is matter number 1715-001, Alicia Lewis. This matter was tabled last month to allow Ms. Lewis time to file her PFDS form. As of today, unfortunately, she has not filed her form. Ms. Lewis appeals her fine due to financial hardship. She admits to ignoring our filing notifications and claims that she assumed she did not need to file as she had separated from district employment. Although we are sympathetic to Ms. Lewis's situation and were inclined to abstain from opposing it, unlike the others on this list who filed their FDS statements contemporaneously with their penalty waiver requests, she still has not brought herself into FDS filing compliance. Accordingly, OGE opposes this request.
So if I recall the last time, she had the exact same excuse as someone else that you recommended that we grant the waiver request. The only difference was she hadn't yet filed her FDS, and so we were going to give her time. Did we reach out to her in the interim period?
Yes. Good morning, board members.
Good morning.
I reached out to her earlier this week to find out if she had filed, and then, of course, I looked up her status on our e-filing system. She had not filed. She didn't respond to the email. Even though she didn't respond, I went ahead and forwarded her matter to the IT specialist to make sure that she did receive assistance if she hadn't received it up until that point. IT specialist responded and said that he had reached out to her to try to resolve the problem, but I didn't receive any further update. So at this point, what we do know is that she has been contacted by IT to resolve whatever e-filing issues there may have been, but as of today, she is not yet filed the form.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions? All right. All those in favor of accepting the recommendation of the director and denying the waiver or request for Alicia Lewis, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Waiver request has been denied. Thank you.
Okay, the next matter is number 19-0002R, James Armstrong. Mr. Armstrong is a former DCPS employee. He claims that he changed his address in February and he did not receive our noncompliance correspondence. Mr. Armstrong timely filed his past two public financial disclosure statement forms. Therefore, our office does not oppose this request.
Any questions? All those in favor of granting the waiver request for Mr. Armstrong, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Waiver request has been granted.
Chairperson Collier, I just handed you all of the orders, so we get okay. The next item is number 19-0001R, Joseph B. Tolman. Mr. Tolman is a former UDC law professor. He claims that the UDC law faculty were not designated in the past to file FDS forms, that he was confused by his designation, and that he ignored our previous correspondence because he hadn't been required to file before. He claims that he's not been present at or worked at the law school since 2016 as he was on sabbatical and then ultimately left the school. OGE does not oppose this request.
Any questions? All those in favor of granting the waiver request for Mr. Tolman, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Waiver request has been granted, and I do not have the order for Mr. Tolman.
Thank you.
Next one.
Next matter is number 19-0003R, Julianne Vinson. Ms. Vinson is a former DCPS employee. She claims she only received the fine notice and not earlier correspondence from our office, and that she has timely filed her financial disclosure forms in the past. Our records indicate that she filed her 2016 form on May 15th. I'm sorry that the year is wrong. May 15th, 2017, and that she filed her 2015 form on May 26th, 2016. OGE does not oppose this request.
Any questions? All those in favor of granting the waiver request for Ms. Benson, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Waiver request has been granted.
The next matter is number 19-0004-R, Jill Forbes. Ms. Forbes is a former CFSA employee. She claims that she only received the fine notice and not earlier correspondence, and that she was not informed upon her departure from the district from district employment that she had to file a final PFDS form. She also notes that she had a change of address, and she recently moved to Massachusetts. OGE opposes this request, and we oppose this request essentially because she made claims about filing her past forms in a timely manner, and we couldn't find any evidence actually that she had filed past forms. So we decided we should probably oppose this request.
Was she required to file past forms?
I believe that she was. We have found no record of her being designated. I only really went back a year, last year and the year before. We had some theory about her possibly having had a name change or being a confidential filer, but I couldn't find any record of her on either list. We reached out to the ethics counselor for her agency, and we didn't receive a response. So, I mean,
this is a former employee also?
Of CFSA, yes.
So the only difference between this one and the previous ones is she says she filed her previous FDS timely, but you can't find a record of that.
Right.
If I can speak to that, to me it goes to the credibility of the her explanation for the other reasons that would justify the waiver. I mean, we've got no indication that she was ever designated to file either a public or confidential report. There was no – when I looked through the system, I didn't see anybody from CFSA with the first name Jill being designated to file as a public filer for any of the years that were available on our website and the old DataNet system. And you'd think that there would be some evidence that she had actually filed or even been designated to file for her to make that claim in her defense and as a justification for the waiver request. And in my mind, the absence of any evidence that would corroborate that claim caused me to have suspicions about the veracity of the rest of the defense.
Has she since filed?
Yes, I believe she did file. In fact, everybody that appears in the notes today has since filed. Other than Ms. Lewis, yes. We could table it until the next meeting, as we did with Ms. Lewis. That might allow for me to follow up with the ethics counselor and do some more investigation about a possible name change.
And ask her for proof that she is filed. I'm inclined to grant her waiver, but we can table it until next week and see if she can provide proof or you get proof from the ethics counsel sufficient enough to satisfy your concerns about her veracity. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Asia. I'd like to just take a moment to point out the new case numbers that are being reflected in some of these regulatory matters. These are the new CMTS case numbers, which I think are a little more logical and provide more insight into the nature of the cases. The first two numbers, 19, reflect the fiscal year that the case was opened. The letter at the end reflects the type of matter it is, whether it's a preliminary. If it's a preliminary investigation, it'll be a P. If it's a formal investigation, it'll be an F. If it's an audit, it will be an A. If it's a complaint, it's a C. And if it's a regulatory matter, a waiver or anything of that nature, it will be an R. And then the numbers in the middle reflect how many of that particular case type have been filed at the time this matter was created. So at a glance, we can tell how many of a particular case have been created during a fiscal year and know exactly what type of case it is, which I think is an improvement.
Excellent.
Lobbyists. testing out the new electronic framework for the lobbyist program. Last week, Mark McDermott from Octo sent me a summary of the feedback they received from both the volunteer lobbyist beta testers and OGE staff, as well as Octo's actions to incorporate that feedback in their development efforts. I'm still reviewing that feedback and considering a change control request that would authorize Octo to start the process of pushing the application live, including scanning the production servers for security vulnerabilities. If all goes well, Octo hopes to have the application ready to be released into production by December 1st. Second matter, we are making good progress in the collection of the registration reimbursement owed to BEGA by nonprofit organizations who did not qualify for the reduced registration fee. We sent second notices to the organizations that failed to respond on October 3rd, 2018. So far, we have received $8,400 out of $10,000. Our auditor has added this procedure to the BEGA audit procedures to be performed immediately after every registration period so that he can follow up with violators immediately to collect any outstanding funds.
Excellent. And is that also something that the compliance specialist can do?
It should be a joint effort. Third, to more proactively identify lobbyists who may be working in D.C. without proper registration, our auditor has recommended that we request sign-in sheets and Outlook calendars from certain public officials. These sign-in sheets and calendar entries will be compared with the lobbyist registration listing so that persons suspected of lobbying without proper registration can be contacted immediately. Like the profit/nonprofit undertaking, this project will help in strengthening lobbying enforcement and may further enhance our budget with a wider pool of registrants. Non-confidential investigations. First matter is number 1634-001, N. Ray Rochelle Wilson. We are finalizing a negotiated disposition to resolve Mrs. Wilson's failure to file fully completed and accurate PFDS forms that truly and accurately reflected her and her spouse's business interests, activities, and positions with outside organizations for calendar years 2014, 2015, and 2016. The negotiated disposition will establish a payment plan for the $2,750 ministerial fine that we imposed against Mrs. Wilson for these violations. Next matter is case number 1031-016, N. Ray Antoine Wilson, and 1031-017, N. Ray Jennifer Niles. Pursuant to D.C. Official Code Section 1-1162.12a, we conducted formal investigations into whether the actions of former Chancellor Antoine Wilson and former Deputy Mayor Jennifer Niles in connection with the Chancellor's daughter's mid-year transfer to an out-of-boundary school during the 2017-2018 school year violated the Code of Conduct.
I know you can't provide a detailed update, but can you just give us a summary status?
Yes, the team did believe that the actions had violated the Code of Conduct. They've provided me with some recommendations, and we are planning to engage Ms. Niles and Chancellor Wilson in discussions about negotiated dispositions. And last matter is number 1101-003, N. Ray Jack Evans. This is a formal investigation into allegations that Council Member Evans violated the Council Code of Conduct. We have stayed our investigation in this matter. And that concludes my report.
All right, we now have an opportunity for public comment. I'll remind public commenters you have 3 minutes. Anyone in the room?
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Binder. Can you hear me?
Just give me 1 second, Assistant.
Can you hear me?
You can speak now.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Michael Sindrom, disabled veteran, served our country more than most. How are you?
I'm well, Mr. Sindrom. Good afternoon.
Jack Evans, it indicates the investigation has stayed. For what reason and for how long?
I'm really not at liberty to go into further detail. I don't know how long the investigation will be stayed.
I would just hope that the good councilman, you know, 20 years, no term limits, is not given preferential treatment. And I think some action needs to be taken, and it needs to be taken timely. Last meeting, Madam Chair, I had, again, raised the issue about Public Service Commission employees brought under the watch of BEGA, to which you said no go. However, Mr. Flowers said otherwise. So I just wanted to get clarity that we're on the same page.
Mr. St. John, you can discuss this with Mr. Flowers after the meeting.
My question is, do Public Service Commission employees come under BIGA jurisdiction? And if so, I'd like whatever it is in writing.
Mr. St. John, you can discuss this with Mr. Flowers after the
meeting. I'm asking you, Madam Chair, because according to you, they don't.
Okay, so we have opportunity for public comment. You can comment. This is not question and answer.
Well, I'm commenting. I'm saying there's some confusion here, and it needs to be resolved.
Okay, is that your only comment?
Comment, question, whatever you want to deem it, and request then accordingly to have in writing the applicability of BIGA jurisdiction with Public Service Commission employees in writing. And my address is 6645 6645 Georgia Avenue Northwest, Apartment 306, Washington, D.C., 20012. One other request I would make, and that is this. With the agenda and other items to be discussed prior to the meeting, I'd like to have that sent to me so I can intelligibly follow and respond in kind to what's going on there. I'm blindsided because I know nothing until it's brought, you know, orally, but these things obviously are deliberated ahead of time. I happen to be cybernetically challenged. So an American Disabilities Act 1990 reasonable accommodation is in order and requested.
Mr. Sindrum, I think we've already discussed your reasonable accommodations, but again, I'm going to refer you to Ms. Allen to further discuss what accommodations you request and you are afforded.
That the accommodation deals only with
coming,
weighing in
now.
Public comment.
Do you have any other public comments? All right, hearing none, I move that we enter into executive session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-575B to consult with an attorney to obtain legal advice and to preserve the attorney-client privilege between an attorney and a public body pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-575B4A to discuss personnel matters, including the appointment, employment, assignment, promotion, performance evaluation, compensation, discipline, demotion, removal, or resignation of government appointees, employees, or officials pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-57B10, and to deliberate on a decision in which the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-575B13.
Second.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the time is now 12:26. We're now in executive session.
Mr. Simpson, I'll call you back in 30
seconds. All right, so the time is now 1:01. We are back on the record. We have one matter to report out. In re Antoine Vincent, number 1705-001. The board has entered into a negotiated disposition with Mr. Vincent, and the negotiated disposition will be posted on the BIGA website by close of business today. That is it for matters today. The next board meeting will be December the 17th at 10 a.m. Thank you.